There's always a lot of discussion about homelessness. The people who have homes can't quite seem to figure out why so many people are living on the streets and what can be done to get them all into permanent homes. Many, many agencies and individuals are working on solutions. Our guests this hour deal with homelessness through art. They are the composer and the principal singer of a new piece of music to be heard for the first time on the Brit stage. It's called Emergency Shelter Intake Form. I should point out the Brit stage in this case is not the Hillside in Jacksonville. Because of smoke, the Brit Orchestra moved this week's concerts indoors to North Medford High School's auditorium. Misha Berger-Gozman will join us in just a bit, we hope. Gabriel Kahane is the composer, a singer-songwriter, son of Jeffrey Kahane, who appeared at Brit last year and visited the exchange in August. Thank you so much for joining us today, Gabriel. Kahane.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about your work and what makes you the happiest and most engaged.
Oh boy, that's a rather broad question. Well, I'd say that, most generally I tell stories through song. Words and music are sort of inextricably linked for me in just about everything I do, whether I'm playing in a club with, a piano and a guitar in a smoke-filled room or a smoke-filled concert hall, as the case might be, or on stage with a string quartet or an orchestra. I do a lot of things, ranging from the folk pop world to writing pieces for large orchestras and ensembles like that. And I think ultimately I'm interested in the human condition, in trying to filter the world as I see it through music and trying to understand the world better through the stories that I tell and the music that I write.
So homelessness wouldn't be the first issue that you've addressed in music, it sounds like.
No. A few years back, I did a record called The Ambassador, which is kind of a study of Los Angeles and its architecture, looking at its built environment, looking at the stories from film and fiction, looking at the sort of political history of Los Angeles, the way it sees itself. I did a piece about the WPA through the wonderful travel guides that were written in the 1930s, commissioned by the Federal Writers Project, the Oregon Guide among them being an incredibly beautiful document. All sorts of things. And this piece is sort of a more explicit dive into toward linking my social conscience and my art.
Let me come back to the ambassador thing you were talking about, because I mean, how do you express things like architecture through music? I mean, what are some of the things that you had to sort of map out in your head to say, here's how I tell this story?
Well, in that album, I was using street addresses as a kind of organizing principle. Oh, it's Misha Berger-Gozman has just entered with some gorgeous extensions.
Hey,
we're on the air.
That's what white people call them.
Okay. But did I not see your hashtag yesterday? Hashtag extension.
Hashtag have fun was the.
Oh, okay.
Good to
at any
you
rate,
you have a seat. Below.
So we are on the air, and we're talking about architecture and music. Basically with that record, I took a series of buildings and found stories that kind of inhabited those buildings, and so occasionally it was kind of explicitly linked to the architecture, and in other cases it was dealing with the characters that inhabit those buildings, whether fictional or historical.
So then when doing emergency shelter intake form, and I understand it is very explicitly about that act, I mean you had to make some decisions just to focus on that portion of homelessness in the first place, it seems like.
Yeah, I guess the first thing I would say is the piece is not really about homelessness. The piece is really about inequality and the resurgence of deep poverty in America. We're at a moment where inequality is at historic highs that rival the conditions in France before the French Revolution. Certainly, the previous Gilded Age of the 1920s.
Huge separation of huge the very wealthy.
Yeah,
and the very poor.
Yeah, yeah, and so. For me, finding my way into this project was difficult. The Oregon Symphony and Brit had asked for a piece dealing with homelessness. And there's, of course, the kind of optics and ethical issue of creating a work of art for institutions that tend to cater to the economic elite, but dealing with a pressing social issue that deals with a population that for the most part doesn't have access to these spaces. And so I was trying to find a way to broaden this inquiry to kind of interrogate the audience, not just, this is what happens to the most vulnerable people in our society, but rather this is the way that we're all interconnected, and also to try to drive home the idea that experiencing homelessness is much closer to those of us who have than we might believe, particularly at a time when our safety net is being gutted, that, you know, one medical emergency could land any one of us in a situation where we're deciding between paying the rent and paying, you know, for health insurance, paying the gas bill, the grocery bill, and so on and so forth.
Was this a package deal? Did you compose this with Misha Berger-Gosman in mind?
I did indeed. Yeah, Misha and I met at the Verbier Festival in Switzerland 12 years ago. And
Before either one of us had kids.
And I remember hearing, I heard Misha sing some music by Alban Berg, one of the great composers of the Second Viennese School, who writes fiendishly difficult music. And so I heard her sing this on the stage with this incredible operatic voice. And then 3 hours later, after the concert, we were all in a bar with the great German bass baritone Thomas Quasthoff, and Misha starts singing standards, you know, singing Gershwin tunes. And I thought, oh, this is a woman I need to work with.
And indeed,
and it only took 12 years.
So here we are, Misha Berger-Gosman and Gabriel Kahane, soprano and composer, respectively, in the piece called Emergency Shelter Intake Form, premiered with the Oregon Symphony in May, and it will be on stage with the Brit Orchestra tomorrow night, moving to North Medford High School. And we'll come back and talk more with Gabriel and with Misha when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about homelessness and music and homelessness portrayed in music tomorrow night by the Brit Orchestra in a concert at, well, that has been moved to North Medford High School because of the Rogue Valley smoke. We have with us the composer, Gabriel Kahane, and the principal singer, Misha Berger-Gosman, a soprano. And you can join the conversation on the Exchange as we explore what it is like to explore a fairly critical social situation through art. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join us by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Misha Berger-Gosman, thanks for joining us. Sorry you had a little difficulty getting here.
Listen, it was completely my fault. I just moved slowly. I'm not going to blame anybody but me.
You got here. That's the important thing.
Definitely here.
We're all here.
Present.
So we got a little bit of a build up to you from Gabe, who got to see you perform 12 years ago. But what are the things that motivate you? What are the things that you're most proud of in your career?
Well, I think in my career, that's a very important distinction to make, because I think my greatest accomplishments don't happen in the arena of my job.
Got two kids, I understand.
I have really great parents. I have people who are very loyal to me. I think building loyalty throughout your life and security in a spiritual sense is kind of the goal of life. If there's anything that separates us from the animals, it's our ability to choose to give. And I think that Gabe, with his piece, has given us an opportunity to acknowledge the path we're on, which is headed for destruction, frankly. I mean, in our modern time, to contemplate the fact that homelessness is a politically motivated movement that by sheer force of will alone we could solve, but the odds are stacked against us. And in Canada, I mean, I'm Canadian, so I have a different system under which I live, but disparity that exists between the rich and the poor is very similar.
Really? Same thing in Canada?
It is. Similar. Now, of course, everybody knows of our sweet, sweet healthcare situation.
Yeah. So the social safety net is somewhat more robust.
It is a little bit more robust, but you can't really expect your social system to function unless there is a psychological will of the people to support it. And I see the reverse happening in the United States than there is in Canada, insofar as people understand that everybody should have access to healthcare and consistent housing. But the people who actually make the decisions are hidden behind a bunch of red tape that we have allowed to strengthen itself, making it practically impenetrable and yet not impossible. I mean, your vote does count. It does count. But they would like for us to believe it doesn't.
Yeah.
So that's the social and political backdrop for the piece of music that Gabe Kahane has composed and that you're singing. He already described you singing somebody else's work that was fiendishly difficult. How challenging is this work?
I mean, the beautiful thing about a composer as evocative as Gabe is that it can't go any other way. I mean, I try, like I really try. Like there are some notes that I just am not, I have to really focus on getting right. But it is so incredibly him in its style that I need him to be like almost next to me. I need to be able to pick up the phone. I need to be able to, you know, I listen to all of his albums and can understand the aesthetic. And yet I also know that I am a muse through which he has written this work and it's meant to flow through me. So there's a lot of me in it too, which I really, really appreciate because sometimes I've been written for quite a few times and you can tell the difference between somebody who wants to herald your strengths and somebody who just kind of wants to
punish you.
My last wife was a soprano.
I want to jump back in though. I know we want to talk about art, but one thing that I learned over the course of working on this piece, and this may be self-evident to listeners, and it may not be, which is just that we tend to think of homelessness as this isolated phenomenon. And as I was saying earlier, this piece to me is much more about income inequality and the resurgence of deep poverty in this country. And I think the thing that I would just love to point out is that homelessness is one node on a much broader spectrum of the ways in which poverty manifests itself in any society. And street homelessness, those who are living unsheltered, are, while they're the most visible people living without a home, there are perhaps even more insidious forms of homelessness, which is all those people we don't see, the people who are doubled up, the people living in hotels, the people living with family.
Which we hear a lot from people who deal with homelessness, the people living
in shelters. And so I think that societally we have a skewed sense of what homelessness means because we think kind of strictly of those whom we see on the street. Mm. And that also, I think, pushes us in the direction of thinking that everyone who's homeless is battling mental illness and substance abuse mm-hmm. problems. And while that is, of course, you know, often linked, that's more often the case with people who are unsheltered than with those who are living in those other circumstances that I described.
So, what kind of research did you do? You actually went to, I mean, it sounds like you know exactly what is on an emergency shelter intake form, the name of the piece.
Yeah, so I started volunteering at a shelter in Manhattan on 35th Street. I live in Brooklyn, and through Facebook, I sort of put out a call, and I said, "Can anyone tell me if they've ever been evicted?" Because I read Matthew Desmond's wonderful book, Evicted, which won the nonfiction Pulitzer.
He was on a few years ago.
Oh yeah, he's phenomenal journalist. And reading about his research and his reporting, you learn that there's this whole kind of class of people who are not homeless, but who are constantly fighting to remain in their apartments, getting evicted, finding another apartment, getting evicted, finding another apartment, and
it's such an endless cycle in Milwaukee, as he portrayed it,
and not just in Milwaukee. I think throughout the country, and he makes this kind of heartbreaking comparison. He says that eviction is to black women in America as incarceration is to black men, which is to say that black women experience eviction in America at rates of something like 8 to 12 times higher than anyone else.
And the thing about if they complain or have
Yes, yeah. Well, and there's this other phenomenon having to do with domestic abuse, where frequently these landlords of these kinds of properties will have a policy where if the police are called more than twice, they're automatically evicted. So you have these women in abusive relationships who are deciding, do I call the police on my abusive partner or do I keep my apartment? And this happens time and time and time again.
So stay in a house or stay beaten.
Essentially. But now I've forgotten what the – oh, yes, my research. Yeah. So I did a lot of reading starting with going all the way back to Jacob Riis's book, How the Other Half Lives, which is this incredible study of tenement life in New York City at the end of the 19th century. And that's a book that actually had a huge impact on policy toward the poor, housing policy in New York City. Going all the way up through not just Matthew Desmond's book, but also this extraordinary book by, I want to say, Richard Rothstein called The Color of Law, which is a study that came out last year or the year before about state-sanctioned housing discrimination and looking at the ways in which the federal government participated and reinforced housing discrimination largely against African Americans from Reconstruction to the present. This still happens. And that's an element of the piece that sort of creeps in toward the end. But it was in the interviews that I conducted with a lot of the volunteers at the shelter where I was volunteering themselves had previously been guests. And they told me their stories. They were incredibly generous. And one of the things that came up in every interview that I did with someone who had experienced a bout of homelessness was the banality of going through the bureaucracy to get a shelter bed, that on top of the crushing humiliation of being without a home, there's also you go to this office and then you get on a bus and get on a subway and you go to this office and you fill out this form. And if you make a mistake on this form, then you have to go back to that office. And I was trying to find a way to not repeat myself structurally. I've done a lot of projects that are character-based where I inhabit a series of characters. There's a record that's coming out next month called Book of Travelers about a 9,000-mile train trip I took just after the 2016 presidential election where I interviewed a bunch of people I met on the train about their lives. And I didn't want to do that again. And
you'd also talked about having me be a bunch of different characters.
Yes. We had talked about Misha kind of inhabiting all of these roles at every sort of node along the spectrum of homelessness, from, you know, real estate broker to housing developer, real estate developer to slumlord to person experiencing homelessness to social worker.
So
But we didn't end up doing that. And in terms of finding a dramatic structure, I ended up deciding to take this form and then to kind of do cut up collage art with it in a sense and to start with the form and then make erasures and add my own text in some cases that grew out of my imagination and in other cases grew out of the interviews that I did.
The piece is called Emergency Shelter Intake Form. It's in no capital letters deliberately. I even saw the score. Teddy Abrams had it in last week. Teddy Abrams is the
it just looks better that way.
And Gabriel Kahane composed this piece. Misha Brugger-Gosman is the principal soprano singing the piece tomorrow night with the Brit Orchestra at North Medford High School. It has been moved from the Hill in Jacksonville because of the Rogue Valley smoke. But this is a conversation you can join about homelessness, about homelessness expressed through art, the appropriateness thereof, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So for, a singer, you're putting this emergency shelter intake form out there. I mean, how much feeling can you put into some of the stuff there? And I mean, how did you look for the ways in which you could really inflect some humanity into the...
Well, it was nice in Portland when we were debuting it with the Oregon Symphony to have time together to really see what the structure of the piece would reveal. And I understand that I am over on one side of the stage while the trio of inconvenient
statistics. I noticed that the chorus of inconvenient statistics, we'll ask about that in a minute.
The chorus of inconvenient statistics are on the other side. You have to decide. I decided which movements would be more emotional, which movements would be kind of first person versus third person, the form versus the victim, the witness versus the the instigator. You find a dramatic entry point in which to make it as real as possible for the listener, while also taking into consideration the fact that the course of Inconvenient Statistics does a lot of the work for you as well. And I think it's very difficult to not get emotionally involved, and that's the point. But it's stronger when she, me, the narrator, so to speak, or the form, simply states the text. And having great diction is just an absolute asset, because otherwise it means nothing. Right. And Gabe, to his credit, has written it in a range where I can pretty much speak. So, and also we're amplified to a certain degree, so no one has to strain to hear. These are just housekeeping items that help the piece come to life for people, so that you're not working on things we don't want you working on.
So Misha gets to sing the form, and you're part of the chorus of Inconvenient Statistics, and Kristen Todman and Holcomb Waller?
Yeah, so there's sort of three elements in this kind of, it is a little bit of a theater piece. It is a theater piece with some kind of unusual elements. The chorus of Inconvenient Statistics is sort of a Greek chorus, and the idea for that grew out of my fear that this piece could become extremely dour and depressing and kind of emotionally monochromatic. And I have this belief that comes from my love of great playwrights like Chekhov and Shakespeare, that comedy and tragedy are always deeply intertwined. Mm-hmm. And so the chorus of Inconvenient Statistics acts as a kind of, well, they tell the truth. They tell you about inconvenient statistics, and they're caustic and they're acerbic. And I hope that they're funny and they're angry.
Their anger. So they're correctives for the form. Are they singing back to the form?
Not exactly. They exist in separate planes, and so the action of Misha, which I'd love to ask you about a little bit more, because it's an unusual dramatic ask.
Yeah.
Which I think you're talking about really beautifully, of how do you embody really clinical language. And how does an emotional experience kind of jump out of that? But the trio, Misha will sing a couple of movements, and then the trio just comes in kind of almost with an aside, with a non sequitur. And then there's a third element that's really, I think, important to mention, which is that I've written the last movement to be sung by a community chorus comprising individuals, as many of whom as possible have experienced some of the things that I'm writing about. One of the big challenges for me mentally and ethically in writing this piece for the Oregon Symphony in Portland for an audience that tends to be really privileged is who is this really for? Mm. And is this to make the institution feel like they're addressing,
like they're doing something,
or is it really about trying to break down those barriers? And to the great credit of Monica Hayes, who's the director of education and outreach at Oregon Symphony, we were able to partner with the Maybell Community Singers. The Maybell Center in Portland serves a very vulnerable population and focuses primarily on creating community for people who are the most economically vulnerable. They do house them, they do feed them, but their primary goal is to create community. And one of the ways that they create community is through this chorus. And so it was incredibly humbling and moving to interact with those singers and to watch the orchestra interact with those singers. And we're doing something similar here at Brit, where we've partnered with Rogue Retreat, which has a slightly different mission. I think their mission
They're doing tiny houses in Medford, for example.
Yes, and I think their mission also includes recovery, and we have a lot of singers this time around who describe themselves through their sober time. That was important to them. That I know that they had been sober for 37 years or for a week or for 6 months. And I think it's important to remember that there is this link between our failure to address substance abuse systemically and homelessness and the resurgence of deep poverty. They're all connected.
Mm.
So, but you mentioned the ethical considerations, and I can imagine there's a sense of, well, this is still a little odd, and in that when the players and the audience divide, the audience goes to probably halfway decent homes, and they spend a lot for their tickets, and the people who performed in the chorus go back to something else.
It's an interesting dichotomy. I'm one generation from homelessness. Mm-hmm. My father went and looked for a house when my oldest brother was a newborn. And so that rings very true to me, the fact that I am an opera singer, which is what my parents want for me. And yet I exist in this in between, where I live in a very rural community in Nova Scotia, and I'm in no way uncomfortable there, while I'm also not uncomfortable here or in front of orchestras or traveling the world doing my job. I am deserving of good things, but everyone is deserving of good things. And I use my work to, as much as I can, herald the things that we all deserve. And I think that you can think that large. You can create purpose in your life that allows you to remain accountable for what you buy and support and listen to and feel.
So it's not all going to happen on that stage.
It's not all going to happen on that stage. And I also think that people coming to classical music concerts should not feel guilty. But I also believe that we have a responsibility. To whom much is given, much is required.
All right. Back much more to talk with Misha Brugger-Gosman and Gabriel Kahane about emergency shelter intake form tomorrow night at Brit. Back in a minute, 5. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the intersection of one of the more critical social issues in our society at the moment, and art, and where they meet. And they meet on stage with the Brit Orchestra tomorrow night. It's been moved to North Medford High School with a performance of a very new piece. It debuted with the Oregon Symphony in May. It's going to be heard on the Brit stage for the first time tomorrow night. It is called Emergency Shelter Intake Form, piece of music, which is actually a theater piece, as its composer describes it. Gabriel Kahane is the composer here in the studio with me. He is also part of the trio of Inconvenient Statistics. Misha Brugger-Gosman is the soprano, the principal singer in the piece. And you can join the conversation on the exchange as we work our way through these artistic and ethical issues of dealing with some fairly thorny things in art. And then what does that do for the people who are still stuck in those ethical issues? 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Gabe, you mentioned during the break you wanted to weigh in on the idea that, you know, once this is over, the people who've paid a lot for the tickets go to their nice houses, and the people who are in the community chorus go back to something a bit less.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that there are any simple answers, and I think it's something that I continue to joggle around in my brain. I think that Misha is totally right that what we're after as far as social change does not end when the concert ends, and that the hope is that if someone in the audience feels a little bit more empathy, is opened up to the idea that, again, homelessness exists on a spectrum of inequality at a moment when 43% of families in America cannot afford a basic budget that includes rent, healthcare, food, gasoline, what have you. 43%. It's something like, I don't know, 60, 70 million families who are every month making decisions about what not to pay for. And that homelessness is at the extreme end of that, but that we're all living on that spectrum. And it does make me incredibly uncomfortable that there is a, you know, this volunteer chorus. Of course, you know, in the case of the Oregon Symphony, they made a substantial donation back to the Maybelle Center, and then the Maybelle Center in turn, I think, divided that money up to the singers.
Wow, that's great.
But it's something that as this piece, which I believe there are going to be some more performances next year and in the following season, which is really wonderful that other communities are taking an interest in it. But I'm really trying to think more deeply about how we can deepen the relationship between that chorus and the institution that's presenting the piece, whether it's through a picnic with the entire orchestra and the chorus. But there are no easy answers. And the alternative is there's no such thing as apolitical art. If you choose to omit a politics from the stage, that is itself a politics. You're making a political choice. And so, you know, faced with the choice between trying to be apolitical on the one hand, and on the other hand, doing something that's bold and perhaps problematic in some way and leaves one open to criticism, I would rather do the more dangerous, the latter.
You'll take the criticism.
Yeah, I think so.
I have to say, there was not a chorus up until the Maybelle Singers that I went and saw in their dressing room. Like, when I'm singing, you know, the Verdi Requiem or the Mozart Requiem or whatever that involves chorus, I don't feel led to go to their room and be like, good job, guys. Because, you know, they're union singers. They're at their job. I don't expect them to come visit me either. Mm-hmm. Those singers, and I hope every time we do this piece this will be the case, they have access to us in a way the audience doesn't. They have access to the orchestra and the conductor and the composer and the singers and the soloist the way the audience doesn't. The people who have, you know, arguably paid and make the orchestra possible don't have access to us the same way. And I relish that because they have actually encountered the experience from the right perspective, from the perspective of coming through the stage door. Who would have thought, and I'm sure, and I've had this said to me from the Maybelle Singers, who would have thought from where I was to where I am that this would have been my trajectory? And who knows what will happen next, because I would have never dreamed that this could have happened to me. And Gabe created the piece that made that possible, and I said yes, and will continue to say yes, to this piece because it intersects all the elements of what it means to create art that matters to people.
I have to say it is a new piece. It's just performed the once at the Oregon Symphony. So
Three times.
Okay, yeah. but essentially in one.
This is the second, second presenting.
Second staging of it. Yeah. And not out there on YouTube. I have not been able to pluck pieces of this to put on the air, which good job at keeping it under wraps, I have to say that. We did have Teddy Abrams, who is the music director and the conductor of the Brit Orchestra, on last week, and he mentioned that there were a few surprises in the delivery process.
When Gabriel started writing this piece, we thought, well, it's probably going to be 30 to 40 minute piece. We knew it was a big piece. That's a major commission. But it turned out when it was done, and this was a co-commission with the Oregon Symphony. So Oregon Symphony did the first performance of it just a month and a half ago, and we're doing the second performance. And when it was all done, he told us, well, actually, it's a 55 minute piece. And it's kind of like, well, you bought a new sculpture and you thought it was going to be a 2-foot sculpture, and it turns out it's a 10-foot sculpture, which is awesome because objectively that's a bigger and a more impressive thing to have commissioned.
Now, he did clarify that it is longer than he expected, but then he also added this.
The vast majority of commissions in the music world are kind of on the small scale, a 5-minute piece like an overture, a 10-minute piece, you know, a concerto that features a really famous soloist or something like that, because people are afraid. They don't know what they're getting. You spend a lot of money and you don't know what this piece is going to be when you get it. So putting a 55-minute commission on a program has risk, but this piece is a masterpiece.
So you have a happy conductor. He actually was in here with, I don't know if you saw the Facebook picture, but he was in here holding the score to emergency shelter intake form. So you have you've made your conductor happy. How was emergency shelter intake form received in Portland with these first three performances?
I'm going to let Misha take this.
Because the thing is, people I know were relieved that it wasn't an indictment on their lives. What Gabe has done is infuse it with enough humor and poignancy, the mix of tragedy and levity is really essential to people receiving the message that the piece is hoping to convey. We are all of us complicit in where we find ourselves, but we're not all guilty to the point of immobilization. You know, I think it's
we're not frozen.
We're not powerless, and we're not. What I loved was the sense of relief that washes over an audience that knows they can be part of the solution more than they are having fingers pointed at them for being part of the problem.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's hard for me as the composer to talk about the reception. It just feels weird. I mean, it was very beautifully received. The three audiences that heard it, I think, were really...
I mean, they were on their feet. They were thrilled.
I think back to one of the other central challenges in writing the piece, which is that for me, ambiguity is so central to how art operates, because you want to leave space for an audience, whether it's a listener or a viewer, what have you, to fill in the negative space. And the challenge with something like deep poverty and homelessness is that there is not a great deal of ambiguity in how we've arrived at this situation. It's a series of legislative failures. It's a series of societal failures. And I think really regardless, I mean, at this point, you even hear people from the right side of the political spectrum acknowledging that there are, you know, we've put a little bit too much faith in market-based solutions. And that's not to say that there aren't, you know, market-based solutions for a lot of problems, but as far as income inequality is concerned, the gutting of the social safety net, the rewriting of the tax code to privilege the very wealthy and to enrich the wealthy.
The corporate tax rate.
Yeah, it's clear why we're in this situation, and that makes it really hard to make art that doesn't feel like agitprop and that's not preachy. And to return to the structure of the piece, the intake form is almost exclusively a series of questions. So the first 45 minutes of the piece are, with the exception of some interjections by the Chorus of Inconvenient Statistics, the first 45 minutes of the piece are all a series of questions. And so my hope is that it leaves a lot of space for the audience to answer these questions hypothetically for themselves, as opposed to Misha lecturing them.
Yeah.
And when the Chorus of Inconvenient Statistics does jump in, the extent to which they lecture is all done through with, you know, with a wink and a nod. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there were some complaints in Portland. There were some people, but I think it was less that they disliked the politics and more we didn't come to the concert hall to hear about, you know, social issues. We just wanted beautiful music.
Not your choice. You're
bounded by a few of those. We're not going to have time to play the piece. I just want to let Erica know that. But we did, April Ehrlich, our producer and our Morning Edition host at JPR, went out and talked to some homeless people yesterday about the effects of smoke on them.
People experiencing homelessness.
Right. Okay. Did I say homeless people?
Yeah.
I've been working hard not to say that.
Yeah.
People in homeless conditions. But the point being that they don't have a place to go. They can't move away from the smoke. You know, she talked to people in Hawthorne Park who are just, and so it was interesting in that context to also think about the performance of this piece on homeless being driven to an indoor facility from its outdoor setting by the same smoke.
I mean, it is the height of irony. I don't even know how to respond to that.
Teddy, I landed and Teddy called and he said, "I'm so excited to do this piece, but now you have to write your climate change song cycle."
Yeah, now it's time. I will be climate change intake form.
We laugh now and then we will all burn.
Yeah,
right. Well, burn. Yeah, but it's interesting because we talked about people working in the heat and a a petition to OSHA to get greater protections for workers in the heat. Mm. And one of the bits of information that was put out there by Public Citizen, we talked to somebody from that group, Public Citizen, was that the summers in Boston by the year 2100 could be like the summers now in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it based on several sets of projections, obviously. So, you know, we don't know for sure until those days arrive, but here we are. But
thanks for joining this cheery conversation.
Yes. Thursday good morning.
But this is the thing. So I mean, you guys clearly love what you do, but you also are concerned about the world, and you clearly have gone through you've jumped some hurdles and will continue to do so, it sounds like, to be able to get the issues of our time reflected in your art.
Well, I think gone are the days when you can, you know, travel the world ignorantly and blindly.
Totally.
And gone are the days where singers can't read music or speak any of the languages that they sing in. You know, gone are those days in the classical sense. And I think that we have a greater responsibility, seeing as how the world is now microscopic and we can all reach each other with a click, that we are also able to reach each other's pain with a click. And in acknowledging that, in acknowledging these difficulties, I think we have to take on a certain accountability and do with what we have what we can. And I happen to be a singer. I happen to love super difficult music. I happen to be the person you can call.
It's fiendishly difficult.
Fiendishly. I happen to be that person. And those are my strengths that God gifted me with. So I will also not be silent because I have a voice. People don't have to sing to have a voice. And people don't have to run to be able to move their feet in order to help. And I'm doing what I can. And I fall short all the time. And I have children who I want to protect from the plight that I'm singing about. Mm-hmm. And I have parents who would like for me to live a squeaky clean life because they love me. And so everyone understands the desire for their loved ones to be safe and sheltered. And when you see someone who is suffering under whatever circumstance, it's more than likely at this point a systematic suffering.
Hmm. All right. As you've said, I mean, we got here because a bunch of decisions were made at a number of different levels, societal, yeah, political, and otherwise. And so the piece again is called Emergency Shelter Intake Form. Misha Berger-Gosman is the lead singer, soprano. Gabriel Kahane composed it and will also be part of the chorus of Inconvenient Statistics, along with Christian Todman and Holcomb Waller. And you have Rogue Retreat, it sounds like, providing, yeah, the community chorus.
So. And tickets actually are not so expensive. I think they're $20.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it is at North Medford High School. It was a tighter facility, though, than...
Yes, it's a beautiful hall. I think students and seniors, $10.
Okay. So
yeah.
Tomorrow
super
night,
good.
Come see us.
Orchestra at North Medford High School. Gabriel Kahane and Misha Berger-Gosman, thanks so much for joining us
in the
exchange.
Thank
us.
You for having us.